If you negotiate with your knee before standing up, you're losing that argument. Joint Relief Institute treats joint pain fast. And yes, it's covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000 as in zero pain.
Gordon, thanks very much. Steve Bertrand here. It's time for the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks very much for tuning in. Elise Glink will be along in the second half hour. Dennis Rodkin as well. We'll look at real estate around the site of the new President Obama Presidential Library on the south side, and things are looking up there. But we'll start with Terry Savage, who joins us on a phone line now. Terry, welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Interesting day in the markets. Interesting stuff happening.
Yeah, you know, Orion was just talking about home sales in some pricey London neighborhoods dropping. The Bank of England sort of sent some shockwaves around the world when they decided to cut a key interest rate.
Yeah, that was reasonably widely anticipated. You know, the new governor of the Bank of England, new after about 2 years, was formerly the head of the bank in Canada. He's widely respected. And it was expected that he would have to do something, but he really did two things. He not only cut interest rates there, but he announced that they would do their own version, or resume their own version of quantitative easing, putting more money into the economy. That is a sign of great weakness, a sign that the central bank there, the Bank of England, sees things not looking good as the Brexit impact rolls through the economy. And it has a big impact on us, because tell me this now, how could the Fed possibly raise interest rates now that the whole world is cutting rates? It would be just like a giant magnet swooshing money from around the world to the U.S., making the dollar stronger as they come running here to buy our securities. Probably good for the stock market, makes the dollar stronger, bad for our exports and the money we expect to earn from overseas products. So the world has shifted again. All of Europe is printing now. It makes it tough for the Fed to raise rates, perhaps even until after the election. And we don't have such great economic news here either, so our economy is pretty weak. Only the consumer seems to be holding up at the moment.
A consumer is spending more, but they're spending out of their savings, right? They're not necessarily making more.
Savings going down. So listen to me. I've said this over the years. It's not your duty to boost the U.S. economy by going out and spending. You have to go opposite the trend. This is a time now with stocks high to be boosting your savings and assessing your financial picture while things are not in a panic.
You know, it's interesting you say that, because it really was a patriotic message for a time in the 2000s, right? Do your duty, go spend money.
Spend money, yeah. Well, we saw how that worked out. That just buried you. So we see the statistics. We're starting to spend again. We're starting to build up credit debt, you know, beyond student loans, beyond mortgage loans. Consumer debt is rising. It's not a screaming issue yet. But as you think about it, how can you not have a good feeling when every day the stock market's more or less at new highs?
Right.
You know, so that makes everybody feel, I mean, me too. Okay, well, so what's the big deal? We'll go out and spend a little more. But that's you got to have some self-discipline here.
Hey, you wrote a great column at terrysavage.com. It's at the Huffington Post as well, about annuities and a way to figure out right now how much you need, or if you know, to take your nest egg and figure out how much you would get with an annuity. I think annuity is one of those terms that we hear a lot, but maybe don't really understand.
Everybody just groaned and changed the station.
Right.
First of all, let me start with a warning, okay? Right now, literally billions, almost trillions of dollars of people turning age 65, 66, 78 is starting to roll out of 401k plans into IRAs. That's probably a good idea. Your 401k plan has investments designed for growth, and when you get to the point of almost retirement or in retirement, you need to worry about income. So there's a huge army of annuity salespeople out there. I got a question on my Ask Terry blog this morning, and I'll post the answer and link it to this new column that's up at terrysavage.com. There's literally thousands of annuity salespeople hoping to steer you into their high commission indexed annuity products, promising you income for life, but not telling you that the real income is going to be in their commission stream. Now, a lot of that will change January 1st, 2018, so they've got one more year to grab your money. And I am giving you the answer how to get annuity income without paying those commissions. That's what this column is all about.
Yeah, check out the column and then go to this website, SPIA.com. dot direct. As you write, don't get confused, as I did. It's not dot com, but it's dot direct.
SP is in Peter, IA, single premium immediate annuities. Look, you don't want to take all of your IRA money and say to an insurance company, give me a check for life. Because, first of all, there are programs that return some of the money if you die sooner than expected. That's one drawback. The other thing is that kind of check doesn't increase based on inflation. But you might want to take a hunk, 25% of your rollover money, and buy a single premium immediate annuity, one that gives you a check a month for life now, or maybe you'll say to yourself, hey, I'm only 67. I think I'm okay for 20 years. I'd like to start this annuity at age 85. You'd be surprised how much you can get if you give an insurance company money now and say, I'll start taking it at age 80 or 85 for life. But you don't have to go through a broker. And one of the coolest guys in the industry, he's just a really terrific guy, is called Stan the Annuity Man. He's been a friend of mine for a while now, and he decided that instead of people getting ripped off with these crazy products linked to indexes and all this stuff that gives commissions to the salespeople, he would create a website, SPIA.direct, single premium immediate annuity .direct. And there you can search based on you don't even have to give them your phone number or your name. You have to fill out your age, your gender, your state of residence, the amount of money you would put into that annuity right now in a single premium. And based on that, with one click, you get a quote for how much money you could receive either for as long as you live or maybe a slightly lower amount if you want your spouse perhaps to continue to receive any leftovers. So it's very easy to do. They also have deferred annuities, the ones that start in 20 years. You can do this all online. You don't have to deal with the salesman, but they do have people to help you if you want. Finally, when you get to the point about actually doing it, you'll have to talk to an administrative person, but nobody's selling anything. You can compare. This is how much I get. I have 50,000 in my IRA. I have 100,000. I'm 68 years old. If I roll it into this top-rated company, how much a month will I get for life? No sales commissions.
SPIA.direct. Yeah, great site. All your columns are just outstanding, Terry, but I really enjoyed this one because it explains something for me in a way that really helps. So thanks for that, Terry Savage. Nice to talk to you again. All right, we'll check in again next week, okay? You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. You know, we talk to people from CNET from time to time, Ian sure more than most, but I like to check in on the things that they do with tech and all of that. Every year, every summer, they have what they call a road trip, a special report. And the report this week or this year has to do with the refugee crisis in Europe. It's called Life Disrupted Road Trip 2016. The first stories just went up online, and one of the senior writers of those stories is Ben Rubin, and he joins us on a phone line now. Ben, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Yeah, thank you very much for that intro.
Yeah, well, I tell you, I've been looking at it. I read the story you wrote about Greece, and I want to dive into that a little bit in a minute or two. But just tell me in general about the notion of this series of reports. We know about the numbers. We know about the people. And you're looking sort of specifically at how they're using tech or how people are using tech to help them.
Yeah, exactly. The refugee crisis has been covered for roughly a year now, and what we wanted to do to add a little bit to that dialogue was really look at this from a tech prism. What was really interesting to me about covering the refugee crisis was that this may very well be one of the first ones in the digital or the information age. And so just about every teen and adult refugee that we spoke with in Greece had a smartphone with them and used it for so many different things
I want to interrupt you there because I think that's a significant thing. You know, we tend to think of cell phones, if we're thinking, you know, a little old, we're thinking of those as luxury items. That's not the case anymore. Everyone has a smartphone or cell phone, and they've become lifelines for people.
Right, exactly. And one of the interesting elements that I hadn't realized until I went there was how much of a connection smartphones were used to kind of remind refugees of their previous lives. I mean, a lot of folks that I talked to, their homes had been destroyed, but, and you know, they looked different. They were wearing secondhand clothing, you know, because they had gotten donations. But you could just open up your phone, look at your old photos, and remember, you know, what your life may have been like. And so this was this really poignant additional layer on top of everything else as far as being able to access information, finding shelter, finding food, staying in touch with other refugees that you've met along the way. All these different things were utilized with a smartphone.
Tell me what you found in Greece when it comes to these squats or these sort of unofficial, quasi-official shelters and how smartphones are helping people find them.
Yeah, so with squats, these were illegal houses that were created by grassroots organizations. Most of them were kind of leaned politically left. Some of them were even anarchist groups. And what they would do would...
You got roughed up a little bit.
Used. Yes. We bumped into some anarchists that didn't really want us in their neighborhood and told us to leave in a rather aggressive way. So... It was when you think about it, it's a strange juxtaposition for me from a reporting perspective, because these were folks that were going out of their way to help refugees,
people
that may have been forgotten or ignored. But at the same time, they looked askance at reporters and so did not want us to be there and told us to leave in so many words.
So these squats, though, the word spreads sometimes via cell phone or Facebook page or
precisely.
Things like that, helps people find some of the assistance that they need.
Yeah, exactly. We found actually a lot of squats in Athens through a Facebook page for independent volunteers, and we're able to find some of the squats. Even one of the bigger ones, or one of the more notable ones, had almost 15,000 Facebook followers, a very active Twitter account where they were able to get volunteers, donations, different things like that, because they don't work with NGOs or the government. These are illegal houses, and so the way that they continue to grow and proliferate is using social media channels, online channels, different things like that to get the word out.
We got just a few seconds left. Ben Rubin from CNET, tell me your takeaway from this and what do you hope people take away from this series?
Yeah, I think it's really important to remember the human element of the refugee crisis and to realize that there are more than a million people that flooded into Europe, and a lot of them really do need help. And so it's helpful to really just, with everything else going on in the world and the election cycle, just to try to remind people that this is something important and critical that is going on still. And a lot of these people are still looking for basic things like housing and food. So that's at least what I'm hoping people get out of this.
Life Disrupted, it is a sorry story, beautifully told at CNET.com. Ben Rubin, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. Steve Bertrand, thanks very much for listening. Dennis Rodkin is here as well. He writes about real estate for Crane Chicago Business. Dennis, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Hi, Steve.
President Obama made sort of official earlier this week that the presidential library was to go to the Woodlawn neighborhood right along Jackson Park.
Yeah.
And you've got a piece in Crane's at ChicagoBusiness.com today about how that could mean a real boon financially, economically for the Woodlawn neighborhood. But what I'm interested in, too, is the fact that it sort of looked like Woodlawn was perched for some recovery even before this presidential library announcement.
Yeah, you know, Steve, what a lot of people said is that Woodlawn was on its way up, and the president not putting his library there would not have stopped it. But the president putting his library there sort of fuels an acceleration. When you think of East Woodlawn, when you think of the blocks along just west of his site, his is on Stony Island between 61st and 63rd. So you think of those blocks in there just south of the University of Chicago, just south of the Midway. There's a lot that's been going on. There are some greenhouses going in, some sustainable houses. There are some houses going in, houses and condos that are going to be very contemporary, not something that's been built down there. There's some market rate rental construction going on when a lot that has been built in the past has been subsidized in one way or another. So there's a lot that's happening. And again, so people said, you know, if he hadn't come here, we wouldn't have been hurt. But the fact that he is coming here certainly helps.
I like the line you use. You say Woodlawn has had an air of inevitability.
Yeah, I think you and I have talked about adjacency, right? I mean, the neighborhoods that get spillover, the Western Springs and Clarendon Hills getting spillover from Hinsdale, that sort of thing. Woodlawn has been poised. It's right there next to Hyde Park. It's right there immediately south of Hyde Park. It's got that beautiful park. It's got easy transportation. These are the places that you go to when you can't afford the one next door.
Well, let's talk a little bit about adjacency and then move to the suburbs, right? Because you also write this week about this band of close-in suburbs that is doing extremely well when it comes to housing recovery.
Yeah, yes, and adjacency is in play right there as well. What we're seeing is a lot of first-time buyers, I'm sorry, not a lot of first-time buyers, a lot of people, young families moving from the city out to the suburbs, and a lot of them are ending up, it appears, in these close-in suburbs that feel, one guy said in the story, like not full suburbs. They have an urban feeling.
Right.
The Oak Parks, the Park Ridges.
I think of that because, you know, when we move to the suburbs, I think every city family says, well, we're not going to really go to the suburbs.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
We're going to go to Oak Park or Evanston or something like that.
And, it, you know, it's not a bad step. A lot of people are one of the funny things is that a lot of people now talk about Oak Park as having divvy, you know, like that's a mark of urbanness.
Right.
Once it had a downtown Marshall Field store, that's long gone. But now you say, well, we've got divvy, which in fact they also say in Woodlawn. Divvy has come to Woodlawn. Divvy has come to Oak Park. So the bike share system is sort of a measure now. But yeah, when you look at the band, you saw the map. The band runs all the way from Park Ridge to North Riverside, virtually every suburb in between. What I said is all the suburbs on River Road, though River Road doesn't touch Oak Park and things like that. But that near west, immediate near west of band of suburbs, they've all had home sales bursts in the first 6 months of the year that were well above the rest of the market. Big buying binges in those towns.
Forest Park seems to be doing especially well.
Yeah, and I think the reason Forest Park is doing especially well is that it's one of the cheapest of the three, of the group.
Okay.
It's less expensive typically to buy in Forest Park than in Oak Park. So if you're coming out from the city and really trying to maximize your dollars, you end up in Forest Park.
What I like about this story, too, is that the suburbs are attractive and all of that, but the real migration or the move might have to do with home prices in Chicago going up.
Yes, exactly, because as you and I have discussed, the best recovery in our market has been along the lakefront and a few neighborhoods off the lakefront, but still north side hot zones. So a lot of the people who now can cash in on the appreciation I got in Logan Square or Bucktown can say, let me take that money and move out to Oak Park. So I think that what we might see is some improvement in those neighborhoods or in those areas as a result.
All right, so the suburbs very close to Chicago from north and west are doing well. You also write about a couple that aren't doing so well. Lincolnshire, far from adjacent to the city of Chicago, Lake Bluff too. Lincolnshire had the biggest drop in numbers to down by 20%.
Yeah, and I'm not really sure why. I think Lincolnshire never dropped all that far during the bust. Like every place, it dropped. So a lot of these places like the Oak Parks and the River Forests are saying, well, you know, we're getting all those people who couldn't move out here a few years ago during the first of the recovery years. That's not the case in Lincolnshire, and I can't yet determine why Lincolnshire has dropped so far. It's only the first half of the year. It's not like they've been, you know, years and years of a drought, but I don't yet know what the reason is.
Well, listen, when you figure it out, give them a call, will you? Because I'm sure they want to know.
Yeah, they're waiting for me to weigh in, I'm sure.
Dennis likes to write about big houses with big price tags, and there's a piece about a house in Winnetka, 15,000 square foot house, adjacent to Lake Michigan,
yeah,
for a cool $9.75 million.
And then as of today, I'm not sure if you're aware of this one, now there's one for $15.9 million.
Oh, no.
Winnetka has a new highest price. I may not have given you that story. New highest priced home in Winnetka is $15.9 million. And, Steve, you got to, when you go to the story, you got to click on the video because it, like, you can't help but salivate because they shot it from a drone out in the waves in Lake Michigan. And so from Lake Michigan, you first see the beach. Then you go up a level to this fabulous pool up the bluff, and then you go up farther to their enormous lawn and this huge house built in 1906, and just absolutely astonishing. And $15.9 million, which puts the $9 million one to shame.
That ain't nothing. So that's so that's at ChicagoBusiness.com as well.
Today, yeah.
I want to talk about this with the 9.75 one, though, quickly. No, it's okay, because it's a relatively new construction, right? 2001 it was built. But what I love, and I don't mean this, this is going to sound like sort of disparaging to the homeowner, and I don't mean it that way at all. She moved to the house several years ago, apparently to get her kid in a better school. The kid is graduating, so now it's time for her to move on.
Yeah.
So in other words, she spent multi-million dollars to move to the suburbs for just a brief time while her child was in school, and now she's, well, I don't know if she's going to downsize or what, but she's moving on.
Yeah, you know, it's another version of the putting your, moving to the suburbs for your kids in schools, but just at a level that you and I don't operate.
Yeah, it's a very different version, Dennis Rodkin. Hey,
sorry.
Great to talk to you again. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve.
We'll check in a couple weeks. Read those stories at ChicagoBusiness.com. Dennis Rodkin. It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. Elise Glink is here. You know, she's the co-host for Monday Morning Marketing. You can hear that at WGNplus.com each week. Elise, welcome to the program.
It's nice to be here, Steve.
You also have a new venture of your own, right? Best Money Moves. We have to set aside some time to talk about that soon.
I love that. We're just on the verge of introducing it to everybody. So good.
I didn't just jump the gun, did I?
No. For you, never.
Sorry. Okay, well, when the time is appropriate, we will have Elise Glink back to talk about that. It's always an appropriate time, I guess, to take your business and take a step back and sort of give it a look. You know, it's sort of like spring cleaning or whatever. Give it another look to see what you're doing, how you're doing it, and for purposes of this conversation, probably how you're conveying to others what you're doing and how you're doing, right? Explain for me the significance of getting a fresh look at your business.
Well, it's really about understanding the message. And, you know, as a person who's been in the media for a long time and run a communication strategy firm, I'm all about message. I'm all about how is it that people are hearing your message and what you're trying to communicate. And it's particularly mission critical if you're building a business or, like me, starting a new one, because you have to understand how people are hearing what you're explaining to them. And I think for a lot of people, they don't understand what the old joke is. And the old joke is, if you want to know what your story is, meaning your message, you ask a journalist. And the reason why is because journalists, or recovering journalists like myself, you hear things differently. If you've been in your business a really long time, you're probably using the same messaging techniques over and over again, the same kind of marketing, but stepping back and learning how to hear yourself objectively again for the first time in a long time is super important.
You know, put maybe another way, maybe more awkwardly, is when you try to sell your house. You know, people walk in and they see something altogether different in your house than you see it. If you're in your business day after day, your view of it sort of becomes skewed. It's not the way the outsiders see it.
Yeah, that's a perfect example, actually, because whenever, you know, I write about selling your house and advise people on how to get their house into sort of sell-ready shape, you want to take all the clutter away. You want people to see what you want them to see. So if you've got a beautiful view in your living room, but you've stacked boxes and furniture in the way so people can't quite get there in a straight line, that's going to detract from the message of, hey, I've got a beautiful view. Likewise with your business. You know, what is the one thing, if you could strip everything else away, what's the one thing that you want people to be able to take away from the conversation or learn from your messaging? And I think when you you see lots of other stuff getting in the way, and there's lots of examples of this in the political arena on both sides right now,
sure.
It's really hard to understand what people stand for or what your company is doing and what you're trying to sell somebody.
That's an interesting point, right? If you look at the candidates, they both had issues of late, Trump more than Clinton, I guess, but of staying on message or trying to figure out what it is you want to convey to your customers and sticking with that.
Right, and I think, so if you're a small business and you're finding that your sales are trending down a little bit, or maybe your click-through rate isn't as good on a newsletter as it used to be, or maybe you're putting an ad out there for a sale and you're not getting as many people taking you up on that or your free trial offer, you've got to play around with the message. It's probably that something else has gotten in the way and you're not cutting through, and with all the noise out there right now, you've got to cut through.
Okay, so here's the thing. I own a small business. I want to, but money's tight. I'm looking at every dollar. I'm trying to get people in, but I also feel like maybe I don't have the luxury of toying around with other messages that might not work, right? I mean, there's a little courage involved there.
There is a little bit, but, you know, if you don't put yourself out there, and we hear this in so many different spheres, if you don't put yourself out there, you're not going to get any new business. And so you have to figure out where it is that you think you'd want to go. If you sat down, and maybe this is a time for a slower afternoon, and you take a bunch of sticky pads, right? So, or if you're like me and you've got a wall where you can draw on it, even better, or a whiteboard, and you carve out some opportunities. If you could have anything you wanted in the business sense, what would it be? And you start writing on the board, and I call that reverse engineering, because that's the goal line. So how do you get from where you are today to where that goal line is? And if you start from the goal line and say, right, well, to get this kind of a result, I would need to have this happen, or and then this happen, and this happen. How do you get things to a place where you've stepped it all the way back to where you are today? Same thing with messages, right? You can go and talk to the person that you would like to buy and say, listen, I'm wondering if I can buy you lunch or a cup of coffee, or let me send you a large basket of fresh fruit. And we can talk a little bit about what it would take to get you in the door for me or somebody like you. If you engage on a very personal and authentic way and you ask for their help, most times you're going to get it. And that's part of the reverse engineering process.
Yeah, it just takes an effort to step away from the daily grind, I guess, to figure out a way to look at things differently and start up a new grind or a different grind maybe.
It is, and sometimes it's you might want to hire somebody on a temporary level, whether it's a consultant or it's somebody who's maybe very young. Sometimes I get the best results by hiring for a social media position. I hire someone right out of college, preferably who's still in college, because that take on social media is different from somebody who's even 5 years older. And so having somebody who gives a completely different idea and brings different tools and techniques and things that they've seen along the way, that's a fresh jolt of energy that most businesses could use.
Elise Klink, great to talk to you again. We'll check in again next week.
You bet. See you then.
Listen to Elise Monday Morning Marketing. It's a podcast at WGNplus.com. Bill and Wendy, just around the corner here on 720 WGN.